You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we return to the world of UAPs, as I'm delighted to be joined by the legendary disclosure powerhouse, Stephen Bassett, alongside filmmaker Darcy Weir. We discuss Darcy's latest film, Volcanic UFO Mysteries, which features some frankly incredible footage caught by the Mexican authorities on their volcanic monitoring system cameras, as well as a raft of interviews with Stephen, Hami Mousson, and more. Stephen also explains his hopes for the congressional hearings in the US, with disclosure inching ever closer as more and more evidence begins to seep out of the shadows. Rather than calling this a conspiracy, Stephen quite rightly calls this a truth embargo. Covering a variety of incidents, we dive into several high-profile UAP UFO events. A big thank you to both Stephen and Darcy for joining me this week. As always, you can support the show by signing up to Patreon for $4 a month, and you can find the link in this week's show notes. We are also on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. We've also got a website, which you can find at mysteriesandmonsters.com. Artwork for this week's show, as always, by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Stephen and Darcy to discuss the truth embargo, UAPs, and much more. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, we delve into the UAP phenomenon with filmmaker Darcy Weir and the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group, Stephen Bassett. Stephen needs no introduction due to his tireless efforts in the field of disclosure as the PRG celebrates its 25th birthday this July. Darcy, Stephen, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Gentlemen, obviously you've collaborated on a recent documentary that Darcy has created in regards to the UFO mysteries surrounding volcanoes and things. And Stephen, you've been extremely involved in this subject of UAPs or the extraterrestrial situation for almost a quarter of a century. Was it an interesting aspect that brought you both together in regards to working on this project?
Well, the truth is, I've been in many documentaries, and because I'm very much supportive of what I call the content creators, the people out there that are putting the information together to inform the people, the world's people, about this subject, because the governments of the world, as you know, don't do that. They're not putting out any emails about this subject. They're not creating any documentaries. They are denying that there is, in fact, a subject. So Darcy has done a number of documentaries, and if you go to his IMDb page, you can see. I think he's done at least 8. So he got in touch with me, and I think I'm in a couple, providing insights from my perspective. At the volcano issue is one of, I think, the more intriguing ones, without question. And I like it because it's based upon high-quality surveillance cameras around volcanoes put up by the government. Other individuals, but high quality, because these volcanoes are extremely dangerous and need to be monitored, and they pick up things. So it makes an excellent topic to provide, I would call, relatively serious observational data. And there's political implications. There's exopolitical implications to it. So I jumped in. I'll probably jump into a couple more of Darcy's docs, because I'm sure he'll do 2 or 3 more sometime this year. And I love the content creators. They are, without them, I could never do what I do. I could not pursue the advocacy of disclosure.
Darcy, what was it, this aspect of the phenomenon that that drew you in? Because as Stephen refers to there, I think one of the more exciting aspects of all this is that this is official government footage that is used in a lot of the capture of these images and these objects that are floating around certain areas, especially in Mexico. So do you think this is a topic that's kind of, once again, it's been pushed to one side and people just don't want to talk about it because the normal explanations, the excuses simply don't wash in these scenarios?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons that I chose to focus on this subject. I think the one reason is because volcanoes and just mountain regions of North America have heralded amazing UFO sightings over the years. And the Mexican phenomenon is kind of underrepresented when it comes to UFO reporting. So I was working with Jaime Maussan. I figured, you know, I really want to tell this story about all these UFO sightings that have happened around famous volcanoes in Mexico that are constantly erupting throughout history. The two most notable ones are Colima, fiery volcano Colima, and Popocatépetl, which is really close to Mexico. And like Stephen said before, it's very dangerous because it's very close to multiple millions of people. Like Mexico City has 30 million plus, and then Puebla, which is even closer to the volcano, is 2 million. So it could really affect people's lives. You know, I figured while I'm telling this story, why don't we just talk about UFOs in general and the implications of those being extraterrestrial related, you know, being the occupants of those UFOs, or the technology behind having those UFOs is not from Earth. Some would say that those UFOs are operated by aliens, you know, that are actually in the craft. And some would say maybe not. Maybe they're just drones that are sent across the galaxy to observe and you know, collect data. Who knows? We certainly have sophisticated drones these days, but not that sophisticated. It's not a great logic leap to make to consider that there may be other races in our galaxy that are employing drone technology that's much more sophisticated to at least surveil what's going on here on Earth.
Yeah.
But anyways, I brought in Stephen. I think Stephen's, you know, his movement, his activism in the disclosure of extraterrestrial visitation here on the planet is very powerful. It means a lot to me. And I think, you know, I really didn't consider myself an activist myself until I really delved into what Stephen's been doing over the years. And even in a documentary I'm working on right now, which is on space related UFOs, you know, stuff that's caught on NASA's government cameras in space, I find that the real truth is that, you know, if you look at conspiracy, the definition of conspiracy, it is that something that's being hidden from the public by a group that is causing harm or is breaking the law. And what I really like about Stephen's truth embargo, it's stopping the truth embargo or breaking down this truth embargo that the United States has in place, it actually throws out the whole idea that UFOs are a conspiracy. Okay? Because UFOs aren't a conspiracy if you consider that there actually have been laws put in place throughout the ages in the United States specifically to protect the public from being presented this data, being brought in on all of this data that the military, the United States military, and all the different agencies has been collecting since the 1940s. And just keeping concealed because they're worried about what it may do to panic people or hurt the economy or hurt religion systems, that type of thing. And I think it's really interesting that we look at it that way rather than this is another conspiracy, because that just helps the debunkers. It helps the skeptics out there that would never consider even looking into this subject. But when they realize that the government's actually starting to release this data because they're ending a truth embargo, they're actually changing the law so that we're allowed to understand this stuff now. Then they can conceptualize it. Then they can understand, oh, wait, it's not a conspiracy. It was actually a law that was preventing people from knowing that stuff. Read about destabilizing everything, destabilizing the country's economies and such. So I think that's the most interesting thing, and it really needs to be focused on over this year.
I think it is a very interesting period of our lives when it comes to the extraterrestrial question and what's been going on for almost 75 years, Stephen, especially because I know you've often referred that you think that the best opportunity we ever had to not have this truth embargo was obviously at the birth of it, when we had that period between sort of 47 and 52, where we obviously had the Roswell crash that dragged everything into the headlines, and then, you know, up until the sightings over Washington, D.C., which it would seem pushed the U.S. government into a corner of suppression, rather, as Darcy refers to there, than any kind of conspiracy.
That's about right. It was 47, the Roswell event. If they hadn't acted quickly enough to change the story and get a new release out and get it into the press, quite a few reporters would have gotten to Roswell. If something like that were to happen in the modern era, well, it'd be over, right? But this was back then, so it took a long time to get places. Propeller planes and no freeways, whatever. Anyway, the point is they changed it. The reporters turned around, went back to their papers, and they wrote it up. And that was it. They had covered it. And that's the beginning of the truth embargo, informally. Then the sightings that occurred after that, and then, of course, the major sighting in Washington in July of 52, really galvanize the government to get very formal and very serious about, they had to formalize this into a real policy embargo. And they did a hell of a job, and they've managed to keep that embargo in place for now 74 years. You see, the interesting thing, you know, Sarsi's a content creator, I'm an activist. Content creators, they have definitely some limitations. They have to, well, first of all, they definitely have to stay with the facts. They can't just create stuff out of nowhere. They can't make false videos, things like that, fake stuff. They gotta not be too biased and present information to the public in a cool way that informs them, gets them across. That's standard. I'm not saying there aren't deviations from that. As an activist, that's not how I operate. I can say anything I want. I'm not encumbered by any non-disclosure agreements or security clearances. I have zero limitations, not only to say what I know, but also to speculate, to try to project, to be a pundit. And that is important when you're dealing with activism, because frequently you're up against authorities that are contradicting the truth. And that's tough. Right. Imagine if you were a physicist at MIT and you're working on some really interesting project involving some area of physics, and the government itself was spending a great deal of time and effort to dismiss this area that you're looking into, saying it's of no value, there's nothing there. Why are you bothering? And even trying to ridicule it. Just imagine that. Obviously, that would be an impossible situation for a scientist. And they would give up immediately and find some other area that the government wasn't interested in. That's the way it's been for this field. the science of ufology, which is a term I don't like, and you'll hear me using UAP, which is unidentified aerial or unexplained aerial phenomena, means exactly the same thing, just doesn't have all the baggage that UFOs accumulated because the government and media have ridiculed it for decades, right? It's not our fault. It's their fault. So I'm able to go places that others can't go. It's why you have activists. Whether they're marching across a bridge in Alabama or marching, in line with to the British troops in India or whatever the hell else they're doing to try to get authority to change its mind or act differently. So right now, I'm doing a slew of interviews, not with Darcy and also others, trying to discuss the fact that I believe that the truth embargo can end this year. That the stage is set for it, the table is set, and it's just a question of when dinner is served. Back in December, pretty much after the states had certified the elections, not the Congress, which is a formal thing, but rather the states, I started talking aggressively about this as we could see developments in February, early March. And by developments, I mean hearings. The stage is being set for hearings. The witnesses, I think, are being accumulated and so forth. However, subsequent developments probably mean it's going to be pushed back. And the two things are, one, the developments of January 6th, without question. Of course, the impeachment of the president, second impeachment of the president, the fact that there's going to have to be a trial in the Senate starting on the 8th that'll last to about the 20th, maybe 22nd, and then the emergence of new variants in the COVID issue. COVID-19 is mutating, sadly, but inevitably. There's been a number of them developing, and I think the situation with the pandemic is going to be much tougher in the next 60 to 90 days than I think I might have thought not 2 months ago. So I think if hearings are going to happen, it probably we're looking at it soonest would be, boy, end of April, May, depending on how the vaccine schedules go. Still, that's very early. And there's a compelling reason why hearings on this subject in the United States should be soon. In other words, should be early in the Biden administration. And I'll be talking about that as well. So, I'm using every opportunity I can to get this message out to people so that they can get fired up, get motivated, talk to other people, talk to media, whatever they want to do, and particularly online, social media, Twitter, Facebook, all that, to start generating an anticipation that this could be it, that there's a lot, I'm not going to go into lengths for the why because there's just not enough time on this program, but I assure you that there are very strong reasons why I'm saying this. Hearings is the way it has to go, multiple hearings over many days, and hearings would then make it possible for the president to confirm the ET presence at last, and we can then move the civilization in the post-disclosure world.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, by all means, correct me if you think I'm wrong, Stephen, for someone that's had an interest in this phenomenon since I was a child, I don't remember a period of my life, certainly, where the UAP phenomenon, the extraterrestrial question, seems to be treated with as much respect as it has been over the last 3 or 4 years. And I know a lot of people seem to think that that's because we're at the gateway of something important finally coming through.
The reason we're at the gateway, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. The reason we're at the gateway is because of the developments of 2017. The Star Academy was the watershed event. And I'm going to be doing a lot of podcasts about this and talking a lot more, because the people involved in the To the Stars Academy had significant limitations on them due to their non-disclosure agreements and security statuses and other limitations put on them by those supporting them within the U.S. military intelligence complex. But I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of the To the Stars Academy and how it emerged and how it delivered to the New York Times extraordinary information that were in two front page stories, December 16th, 2017. That's going to date. It's going to go down in history. And so since then, because of what they did, and they caught a lot of the U.S. government by surprise. In other words, they didn't send out an email in advance saying, here's what we're going to do. We're going to launch this organization. It's got all these former high level people from the CIA and the DOD and so forth. And we're going to be talking about researching the subject and getting information out, et cetera, et cetera. No, they did not. And so when they launched, the Navy was caught by surprise, the Air Force, the Army, the DOD. Now there are people within the military intelligence complex that are supporting them. Otherwise, they couldn't exist. So they have support, but it's not – it's how would you say, private? It's informal. In other words, there are people covering their back, people who cannot speak publicly themselves, who cannot take public actions like the Do the Stars did, which is an NGO, non-governmental organization. So they caught by surprise. And then over the next 3 years, you've been seeing all these reactions from the Navy repeatedly. And then they started briefing Congress, which is what brought me back to Washington. And we started hearing about that. And then we saw a lot of witnesses come forward on their History Channel program, Unidentified. And so people are watching all that. They're seeing all that. And, of course, I'm doing my part to spread the word. And then Twitter has taken off with it. Facebook, yes. So the fact is that the level of expectation for disclosure, as I define it, capital D, an event, formal confirmation by the U.S. president, not that UAPs are real, which is silly. Of course they're real. We've done that forever. But that UAPs are of extraterrestrial origin, that is confirmation, all right? That is disclosure with a capital T. People are starting to get it. Now, the level of excitement and anticipation that you are seeing would be many times greater if a pandemic had not started in January of last year. I mean, that has just absorbed the media and the public attention, and also created all kinds of problems for people, very, very immediate problems, so that thinking about extraterrestrial disclosure and stuff is hardly on the top of the list of just about anybody on the planet, except for me, of course. It's always at the top of my list, but so that has dampened it a little bit. But when you think of how much there is out there in spite of the pandemic, it gives you an idea of how explosive things could get once we finally get those damn vaccines in our arm and can relax a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, as someone that's been a lobbyist for a considerable period of time, Stephen, have you noticed a change in the political climate over the period since the New York Times dropped that watershed article about the Tic Tac?
Yeah. Look, have you heard anything much from the debunkers lately? The skeptics, anything from them? Any of these scathing? Have they showed up on any shows to give counter statements to somebody talking about it? Was Elizondo or Mel or anybody else? No, they're gone. Is the subject being ridiculed by people in Congress? No. People in the Parliament? No. The media? No. Has the media jumped in with both feet to really tackle it? No. The political situation in the U.S. and the U.K. and pandemic certainly is. Kept them busy. I get that. It's okay. But the media, believe me, is ready to pounce when they can pounce. No, we're practically there. This has been a 70-year marathon. Not for me. My marathon's 25 years. You know, I have one colleague that's in it for 50 years, still going. I had a number of others that were in it for a pretty long time, but they didn't make it to the finish line. And I've done marathons, and I'll tell you, when you're doing a marathon and you actually can see the finish line, even if it's off in the distance, but you can see the banners, you know, it's quite a feeling, particularly if you're not particularly in great shape. So I'm just telling people the finish line is there. Hold fast. Keep going. Don't let up. And we can get this done. And I'm going to do my damnedest to make sure it happens. Now, again, can I make the hearings happen? No. Other people are doing that. Is the president going to call me in the White House? No. What I can do to just keep generate as much media as possible and attention, as well as public awareness, to what I believe is about to happen. So those that are in the process of making it happen can't change their mind and back out. I mean, that sounds, you know, maybe simplistic, but it's that simple. It's the way it is oftentimes in politics. You get a situation where the only only thing to do is the right thing. I mean, if you study activist movements, that's usually how it works. You push and push and push and create enough public pressure that the only thing to do left is the right thing. That's happening right now in Russia. People are coming to the streets, finally, because Putin essentially degenerated into a thug and an autocrat. He could have been a great man, but unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. And they're going to come out in the street and drive him crazy, and he's going to do stuff, and there's going to be counteractions. And ultimately, it's very possible, particularly if he assassinates Navalny, that he'll have no other choice but to do the right thing and step down. That's the way activism works. It's a tough path, my friend. Don't take it lightly. I mean, you want to do it, right? Bunker up.
Yeah, wise words indeed, Stephen. Wise words indeed. Darcy, obviously this documentary includes the Mexican researcher, Jaime Maussan. What I've often been surprised about when we talk about the extraterrestrial question or the UAP phenomenon is that there seems to be a bigger appetite and a more relaxed, positive approach to this subject in Central and Southern America compared to North America. Did you or have you found that refreshing or surprising, or was it something that you were completely expecting, knowing Jaime's reputation that precedes him?
Yeah, so to be honest, I kind of needed that refreshing, relaxed approach to this research and the UAP UFO phenomenon. Just because, you know, around 2017, everything had changed. The Trump administration was, you know, flipping over. I was kind of hoping that Hillary was even saying, you know, on late television interviews and stuff, like, I'm going to release the UFO. I'm going to demand by executive order, like, the release of the UFO papers and all that stuff. And I was excited for that. And when that all changed, I really just wanted to change my sights to a different country and look at what they've been doing in terms of researching the UFO phenomenon or UAP. And it's nice in Mexico, especially, they're called OVNIs, which they kind of consider to be almost a paranormal activity because it's a very religious country. You know, they're mostly Catholic Christians here. And they accept them. I mean, there's always going to be skeptics. There's people that have gone up against Jaime Maussan time and time and time again to debunk him and take him down. Over the years, but I've found that he just stands back up. You know, he doesn't really let people crush him because, you know, especially in today's age, everything is about trolling online, right? Like, I've had my fair share of trolls on older films that I've released and such, but you just delete, block, move on, because it really honestly is only fueling their fire if you respond. And he's had his fair share of skeptics come at him, but he's been doing this for over 40 years. He started in 60 Minutes as a reporter in Mexico, 60 Minutos, and he started covering actually Billy Meyer back in the day.
Yes.
And then he started being someone that everybody, in terms of the UFO phenomenon materializing here and being witnessed, people started realizing he was a dependable person to go to because he was going to pick up the case and research it. And without people like him, again, if you go back to Stephen Bassett's description of content creators being sort of civilian activists that are reporting this information and creating content to present to the public, because the government and the mainstream news institutions are usually not taking it seriously. Stephen Bassett is 100% correct. Like, that's exactly what Jaime Maussan is. When I sat down and talked to him, he's an activist. He's super passionate about it, you know? He wants disclosure as much as anybody else that's serious about this in the United States or the UK. But he wants it more from the Mexican government. I feel like there probably would be a trickle-down effect if the United States fully came forward and ended the truth embargo. It probably would change the laws internationally and make it acceptable. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think it's an interesting point that, that Stephen's often referred to in the past, that this seems to be a very U.S. government-led initiative, this truth embargo. Primarily, I suspect, because of their power after the post-war in the NATO area. As Stephen has referred to before, Russia and China have gone their own way and done their own things. But clearly, everybody in the West seems to be in the thrall of the U.S. government's stance on this point.
That is correct. It's, I don't think it's sinister in any way. The E.T. thing exploded in 47. And there were sightings all over the world, so all of the major governments were sending up airplanes and trying to intercept them and what have you. So they knew something was going on. We know there were more crashes than just Roswell. So essentially, the governments, not the general population, but the governments are figuring out that something like this is happening early on. And at that time, the world was in. There were two parts to it. Three parts, really. There were parts of the world that were just so underdeveloped that this is simply not even something that's going to be part of their life, part of their world, and they're not going to engage it at all. And then you had the Western nations, the U.S. and the U.K. Had defeated the Axis powers, both Germany and, of course, Japan, and the U.S. demonstrated it had nuclear weapons. So. And the communist, Soviet Union dug in, and it was immediately a confrontation with them right off the bat. And we had an Iron Curtain across Europe. So the West was going to be in a confrontation with the Soviet Union. The West knew that the Soviet Union had the nuclear secrets, were going to build their own fission bombs and fusion bombs, which they tested not long after 47. And the West knew that they were building missiles as well. They got some of the missile scientists from Germany. We didn't get them all. So there you go. It's 47, and there it is. And so the Western nations knew that the only nation in the world, because the U.K. was in much worse shape than they were at the end of World War II, and that could defend the West against communism was the United States. And so whatever United States wanted to do, they were fine. They were going to back it 100%. And the E.T. issue was major to the U.S. They knew it was an issue they wanted to classify. And so I'm quite sure we'll never see these correspondences. They were probably not in writing, but the key nations were contacted by our White House, possibly could have been just through the intelligence communities and intel to intel, basically saying, look, we got to keep this under wraps. And we need you to go along with that. So they did. And obviously the Cold War just got worse and worse. 86,000 or so nuclear weapons with eight countries by the mid-80s. So the idea that they were going to turn on the U.S. and undermine its very important decision was simply not going to happen. Meanwhile, Communist China and Communist and the Soviet Union had no interest in bringing the subject out because they were much worse than now, obviously, extreme control states. Major, massive ideological control states where somewhat not quite as bad as North Korea, which is the ultimate example of this, but bad enough, certainly. And so the idea that they were going to interject into their controlled situation where they're having to monitor everybody does and thinks, the idea that, well, we're not alone in the universe, there's other civilizations here, they could care less about our ideology. No way. And so they – that were fine to sit on it. And so you take those two parts together and you got it. And that really has not significantly changed. We've had leaks here and there and some breakdowns, but that's how it happened. Look, historians will be writing and writing about this for hundreds of years. When I say writing about the truth embargo, which is far more complex, frankly, than the ET presence, right? And how it happened and how it was maintained and how it was possible to get away with it. It's just an amazing story. I wish I had the wherewithal and the focus and the ability to write that book, or at least a book about it. I don't think so, but it's just an amazing thing. 74 years, and we still haven't gotten confirmation of something that virtually was told to the world in July of 1947. You can't imagine how many thousands or tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands or more people who have had to keep that to themselves as they've learned about it throughout the decades, directly, indirectly, or because they're actually working on the issue and kept it to themselves because it was, in their view, the patriotic thing to do. Huge numbers. And that's fine because, as Darcy correctly pointed out, the truth embargo was not illegal. It's not a conspiracy. It is, in fact, national security policy of the United States and its allies. And by extension, I would say, I guess you could say Russia and China. And it was conducted for that reason. They felt that they were doing the right thing. There are probably, I know, people that still feel they're doing the right thing by keeping this from us. So what we're just simply trying to do is assist the transition from truth embargo to post-disclosure world. It is a very difficult transition. It's been underway for a while, mostly since 1992, but we're now in the last phases of it, and even that is extremely complicated, and that's the reason why I'll be doing so many interviews and my own podcast, so that I can try to hopefully explain to people what's going on here, because they just pick up an article here, they see a story there, they see something on TV, and they go back to trying to figure out how the hell they're going to pay the bills because they can't work, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. I'm doing nothing to pay attention to it, and so I'm going to try to translate. You know, it's like, okay, here's what I think is going on. You know, and that's kind of my job, and that way people will be able to participate if they can. But I'm really pushing hard over the next 90 days. I mean, if I don't do 100 interviews in the next 90 days, I'll be quite surprised, because we are still isolated. The vaccines are coming. People can get this information. They're kind of stuck in their house. They can listen and get kind of up on it. Then when the vaccinations start to take hold and people can get out more and we can loosen up a little bit, I think that will be good, because we need to get this done as early as possible in the Biden administration before anything intervenes that could prevent it or people lose their nerve.
Yeah. I think it is a very interesting aspect of it, because most people, like you both quite rightly point out, often consider this to be a conspiracy, and it's not a conspiracy, because clearly this is affecting every country across the world, regardless of their political persuasions and history in regards to this. There are notable cases in the vast majority of modern countries, gentlemen, be it Australia, South Africa, Zimbabwe, South America, all across swathes of Europe. You know, we've got stories that are finally leaking out from Russia and China, Japan. These are events that seem often to be lost in the chatter that I think a lot of people constantly seem to fall into the trap of presuming that this is just an American situation, which I believe seems to be one of these media bear traps that's been allowed to disseminate into the general populace, that people get swayed by the controlling narrative of what is going on.
Well, Darcy knows better than anybody. It's all over in Mexico, South America. It's all over the place. I mean, they're totally into it. They're into it more. The population in Mexico and many parts of South America, particularly Brazil, are more into it than the general population of the United States. What do you think, Darcy? Does that sound right to you?
I'd say it's accepted much more so here than in Mexico than in anywhere else in the United States. In the United States, there are states that it's accepted more than others. For example, California is like, I think it's the rating is like 60 or 70%, in belief that there's UFOs, because California has had so many UFO sightings over the years. Mexico has had tons, and it's a Spanish colony. Some people are still angry about that, especially the indigenous people of Mexico that were here first. Mm-hmm. But it's in their sort of creation tale, many different Mayan tales that say that the gods came from the stars, so it's not hard for them to interpret what we're seeing now as something that's always been here for history. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly why they're more aligned with that truth than Western societies have been, because Western societies have been history has been rewritten. It's been told that the planet is only mankind's only 4,000 years old and such through religion. So that's really changed the story, so to speak.
Yeah. It's worth noting that you hear a lot, and it's propaganda, basically. It's truth embargo propaganda. That, we can't tell the people about the ET issue because religion will just collapse and everything else. Mexico and South America are heavily Catholic.
Yeah.
Heavily Catholic. And they love OVNIs. Mm. They love it. They talk about it all the time. They think it's great. They take photos like crazy, send them all to Jaime Maussan. It's not a problem. It never was a problem for religion. It never has been. It's not going to be. But it's part of the truth embargo. Putting out false narratives like that is, again, legal. It's manipulating the people, but for national security reasons, and I respect that. But you want to know something? I've lived through the entire truth embargo. I mean, it started in 47, and I was born in 46. I've lived through Cold War, Vietnam War, Iraq War, all that stuff, and I'm really tired of national security being used as the simple, easy go-to reason for a long list of stuff, a list that should be much, much shorter than it is. One of the things that's completely eluded the political class in this country for, ever, really, is legitimate secrecy reform in this country. We've taken a couple of very tiny stabs at it. There's been a little bit of progress, but by and large, it's nothing. Drop in the bucket. It's just something that the politicians can't touch, along with a number of other things. So reform of secrecy, reform of the military intelligence community, or even I would call the secret empire, nothing. And so they've had pretty much a free run. And again, not illegal. And probably all well-meaning, service to the country. But abuse of power doesn't happen because people are evil. Abuse of power oftentimes just emerges from the structural context that you're in. If you have a great deal of ability to classify stuff, you're going to classify stuff. And if you overclassify, you get into the area of abuse of power. But it's a process. You just kind of get there. You don't start out there. And that's true of a lot of things. So, again, it just gives you a sense of the complexity that's in play as the Congress starts to approach this, the DOD finally has to start approaching this, ultimately the White House, the Navy, and so forth. But what's important is they are approaching it finally. They really are. They're not diving in with both feet, but they're definitely got their foot in the water. They're stirring it around, and at any moment they could go right in. So I'm excited. I'm really excited for what could happen this year. And I'm hoping this catches on, because has there ever been a time when the world's people needed something cool to be excited about?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, really.
I mean, I was amazed, to be honest, gentlemen, when the Tic Tac video came out, how unexcited a lot of people were. It was as if, you know, I'm looking at this news report and this footage and these witnesses, and I'm thinking, we've never had anything this good come out with this kind of audit trail that we know where it's come from, we know what it is, these people involved in it are talking about it freely, and yet you would look at the general population and they're still talking about sport or what's on television or what they've had for dinner, rather than the fact that we're at this earth-shattering peak behind this curtain that's been pulled around us for the last 75 years.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because sports and everything really got shut down at the starting of the pandemic.
Mm.
And I feel like if they were going to make a more impactful disclosure event, they should have done it around then.
Mm.
Because people that were just completely preoccupying themselves with sports and you know, your typical Hollywood stuff and all that jazz, it's a distraction from the truth, you know, it's a distraction from what's going on, and all that stuff's coming back now. I don't think it's going to stop the eventual hearings that Stephen Bassett's been talking about possibly happening this year.
Mm.
Government, you know, congressional hearings regarding UFO activity and disclosure. Those, when they hit the television, I think they'll be more impactful than ever. But yeah, sports and all that stuff is just a distraction. And people love that because it's easy, it's not frightening, it's not hard to think about. And this subject really is, it's a hard topic for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Your point is well taken about the distraction factor, but the fact is, early last year, the political situation was simply not possible. There was just no way that it could happen under that political situation.
Mm.
So while it might have been a nice distraction, no, it was simply impossible. And the situation this last election could have gone a number of different ways.
Mm.
Would it have been more or less helpful? It would have been better regardless, I think, but nevertheless, it was several outcomes. The ultimate outcome that we got in the U.S. politically was optimal. It was the best possible outcome for moving ahead to get this issue. And that's – I'm speaking in nonpartisan fashion. I'm simply saying better is the best situation without getting into political ideology.
Yeah.
So that pumped me up and got me even more. I mean, look, And so that outcome, as it finally – it's not actually totally settled yet, but as it finally settled, particularly with the end of the Senate races, I became even more excited. This could be it. This should be it.
Hmm. Hmm. Do you think that these aspects that people have focused on over the last few months, the creation of a Space Force, for example, is once again another establishment distraction? Because I know a lot of people were saying, well, why do we need a Space Force? Is this part of this ongoing disclosure? Whereas from my point of view, it seemed to be one of those typical tactics that we've seen so many times over the years. I remember Reagan in the 1980s making a very famous speech to the UN where he talked about, in his opinion, the only thing that could get us past our political and ideological differences was if we were faced with an alien presence that would mean that we would all have to come together.
Yeah.
How did you view that kind of change in the direction in regards to the American militarization of space, Stephen?
It was a toss-off line, but notable. It was connected to the SDI program. I think he got tipped off. It was interesting, but under the circumstances, Cold War was still well underway.
Hmm.
It was not going to go anywhere. But we keep track of all that. We have it all. It's all archived. We have the video and everything else. Notable, not a big deal. Hmm. Rockefeller Initiative under Clinton, more progress there, but it couldn't break through.
Hmm.
But what's happening now is of a different type. And you mentioned something else. Yeah, Space Force, exactly. The Space Force is an anomaly. The state of things now is that the interested public, which is, again, it's not a huge number of people, but the interest, and then within that group is the what we'll call the professional researchers, activists, journalists, and so forth, and the genre people. We pay attention to anything. Anything that happens related to this issue, we jump on it. Okay. So naturally, the Space Force got people's attention. And there was a desire to try to hook it to the ET issue. I think in this case, the hook's not there. It was a maneuver by the president to get attention. It was an easy play. He did a lot of that. An easy play to get attention, show that something is going on. And the Pentagon wanted nothing to do with it. We know that. They didn't want anything to do with it, but because they have their own program. They have there's been a classified space program forever, and they like it that way. They don't want attention. They know that we know that they have that, and we accept that. But they don't want to attract any more attention to it than necessary. Space Force. But the president had a shiny object there, but most importantly, he authorized money.
Yes.
And so you offer the Pentagon money, and they'll create a automobile club, a book club, whatever. They'll do it. And they can't turn it down. So they did it. And they stalled it after they got it going, and it's kind of gone crazy. There's been some silly stuff that's happened, and I feel bad for the people that have been that have gotten into that program. They were drawn into it, right? In other words, they were said, okay, you're going to be in the Space Force, because they're in a really bad place. It's not fun, and they didn't deserve it. If the Space Force, because it exists, gets seized upon by politicians or segments of the Department of Defense as the vehicle to push an aggressive posture regarding the ETs that are being revealed to the people. Yeah, there's ETs here. We've got this space for it. So how about we take $1 trillion and start building some anti-ET weapons? I assure you there are a lot of people, including me, that will be all over that. So we have to watch for that. But for now, it's just a bobble, a modestly funded bobble that in many regards looks completely silly and not needed. And don't be surprised if it disappears.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was quite interesting. I saw one of the latest White House press conferences under the new administration yesterday, I believe it was. The topic of Space Force came up, and they just batted it away. Let's talk about serious issues.
You're paying attention. Are you watching our press conferences?
I've always had an interest in
really?
American politics. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll keep you busy. Not that you don't have plenty there.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
My God, it's whatever. But yeah. Well, look, it's the issue has come up in the White House briefings a few times, and every time we note it with great interest.
Yeah.
Does it go anywhere? And yet, when it's come up, it's been each time it's a little less. How would you say? It's trivial. It's a little more serious. It will. That's where you may see something developing first, or it may leak. Whatever, it'll be in a White House press briefing, but not for another month or so. At least a month, maybe longer, 6 weeks, and then you'll know something's going on. So keep watching.
No, I will do. Like I say, I've had a long held interest in American politics, Stephen. So it's I wouldn't say I'm that sad that I spend my leisure time watching press conference briefings, but I know enough and have, like I say, studied it and got a qualification in American politics. So it's an area and aspect of history I've always had a lot of time for. So things like that, I'm always notable and interested in seeing what's going on, especially when it's things like that and the way it's worded or the way it's dealt with when it comes up. So it's always extremely interesting to someone like me. What I've often wondered, Darcy, as well, is in conjunction with Stephen's points there, Have you noticed that there's been a change in the way that the Canadian government has dealt with it? Because obviously, you know, it's one of those things that often frustrates me, as I say, as someone with a real interest in this subject, that, you know, Canada has a long history of notable sightings that, unless you're really interested in the UAP phenomenon, most people mm-hmm. have never heard of Falcon Lake, or will titter when you mention Shag Harbour. Yet,
Shag Harbour, yeah.
These are monumental events that, you know, as Stephen refers to, once again we have all the ingredients of suppression, confusion, and essentially ignoring people and ostracizing them, that when they do come forwards, or when they did come forwards, they were made to look stupid or ignorant. I remember the gentleman in regards to Falcon Lake was brushed off by skeptics as having too much to drink and falling on a barbecue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Shag Harbour had the similar treatment. I don't think there really is a strong following of... obviously, there's a lot of people that like UFOs and are attracted to this information. Mm. But in Canada, I've always, you know, grown up feeling like an outsider, because in the United States, you know, I pay a visit there and I could have a conversation with somebody on a bus or a waiter or, you know, just somebody I bumped into on the street, and they would be like, oh yeah, UFOs, they're real. You know, it's just I think it's become more accepted in the United States.
Hmm.
And in Canada, you know, it's definitely protected. It's definitely something that doesn't end up on the news as much here. And, you know, I mentioned this before in other interviews, but the Black Vault, you might have heard of John Greenwald's
yes.
Black Vault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So back in 2001, he did a sort of Freedom of Information Act. In Canada, it's called Access to Information Act. And we don't have freedom fries, we have French fries, but we have the Access of Information Act, and John Greenwald asked for documents from our military that said there was an active interest and collection of UFO data still by NORAD.
Mm.
Because Canada and Mexico are both part of NORAD, right?
Yes.
It's true. And at the same time that John Greenwald asked for that information, it affirmed that the United States secretly was collecting all that data. Mm-hmm. So in 1969, the United States government said they had no interest in UFOs after Project Blue Book was completed.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that John Greenwald even had the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, signed a document saying that they weren't actively interested in collecting UFO data. But then he went around, you know, to speak to his mom, which would be Canada, the nicer parent, and said, can you please just give me this information? And we gave it. And so that shows that Canada, Mexico, they're all in on it. It's all part of this law that is secretly a military law that has been established, like Stephen Bassett said, since Roswell.
Mm.
And it's to keep the truth from reaching the public as much as possible.
Yeah.
Let me soften your view a little bit on the general public. Keeping in mind that in the United States, and they do this all the time, man and woman in the street questions, I guess, go out. Typically, less than half of the people that they, well, particularly, this tends to be the younger, we'll talk millennials, okay? Millennials and Gen Z, all right? In the early 20s, late 20s, early 30s, whatever. Less than half know who the vice president is. And you can go down, you know, if you want to ask who their senator is, it gets even worse. And there's all kinds of questions asked like that. And you'd be amazed at what people don't know.
Mm.
Because people have their lives. They live their life, and they focus on that. And life in the modern age is a lot more complicated than it was, say, in, you know, the 7th century. So, however, if you ask the question, do you know what a UFO is, you're getting a 95% response.
Hmm.
95% at least of the public of almost any age above 13 or 14 know what a UFO is. And if you ask, do you know what an extraterrestrial is? It's almost the same, 90%. So the market penetration of the two key things, UFO, which really is UAP, but we got to use UFO in this case, and extraterrestrial, is any company with that market penetration will be worth $100 billion. So the public is enormous of the core issue. Does that mean they know what Rendlesham Forest is? No. The best known event-related event in history is Roswell. I don't know what the penetration on that is, but I'm sure it's pretty high. I'm going to guess it could be as high as 40-50% amongst the general population, maybe even a little higher amongst the baby boomers, for instance. So it's there's a lot more awareness than you might think. In other words, it won't take that much to ignite that, take it further. Right, so I assure you, if we have hearings on this issue, the audience is going to be vast.
Yeah. I mean, I find it interesting, as Darcy refers to there, on about we're talking about Operation Blue Book being closed down and this constant skeptical viewpoint, gentlemen, that carried on until the To the Stars Academy sort of kicked the door in 2017, that people would just gleefully accept anything they were told by authority figures in regards to this truth embargo, that there was no interest, there was no collation of data, nothing was going on. And yet we now know that that was all nonsense. And yet people will still fall back into this kind of protective comfort of there being no reason for disclosure, Stephen. There is no extraterrestrial question. There is no UAP. They're all misidentifications and such like. And I find it incredible that despite cast iron proof that people have been lied to by the authorities, people will still look for comfort in the same authority that has been lying to them for the best part of a century.
Boy, let me give you another take on that.
Yes.
I mean, I know what you're saying, but here is how it's actually working out. It is, and always has been, critical to the success of any state, whether it be a nation, well, whether it be a republic, commonwealth, a kingdom, so forth. The people can trust the leadership. There was a time when it didn't matter whether they trust them or not. I mean, you had zero power, nothing. All right. But even there are examples in the past in the UK where – as you go back hundreds and hundreds of years, where the king or the ruling class had some high trust from the people, and it was very helpful. But in the modern era, it's absolutely critical. And so what's actually happened since 1964, which is to me the beginning of the decline of the United States, with the lies about Vietnam, is we went from a nation – that absolutely had extremely high confidence in the United States government, winner of the World War II, defender against the evil communist empire, great economy, all this stuff. People had high trust, the 50s, right? That trust has been slowly eroding since 64 because of major lies told to the American people, and particularly wars about lies about Iraq war, lies about the Vietnam War, and other things. And also a complex of a lot of structural lying by politicians. In other words, they got too good at it.
Yes.
But the entire 70 years, there's been one lie that's been consistent every year. It's not like it happens once in a while. They've had to lie about the ET issue. And every year, more and more people know that. The effect of all this has been to undermine distrust, undermine trust in government. So people don't believe authority now, and they've turned to, and then eventually it spread to the media. So they're easily told not to believe the media, and so they're not believing the high-end media, they're not believing the government, and they're turning elsewhere, to the brand new social media world that was handed to us not too long ago. I mean, here, take this, see how it works out. So in fact, what you have is people believing all manner of nonsense, not believing good information that comes to them, and I'm speaking about the United States now. I think there's a lot of this in the UK as well, but yeah. I'm going to hold my fire there, and I'm telling you, it's causing havoc here, absolute havoc. right? I mean, I swear to God, there are people that if somebody on the internet said, look, you can fly, they'd go up the top of the house and jump off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just the opposite. And one of the principal, a significant factor, is the government has classified too much, so you can't, you don't know what they've got, and you know they won't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also chosen to lie about some of this, and the ET issue is the big lie of all. It is the absolute biggest lie in human history.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in terms of how long it's gone on, the whole number of people that are having to be lied to, namely the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
There's no lie that even comes close. There are countries that have had some pretty nice lies. It may last 5 years, 10 years, whatever. The Nazis had some nice lie for a while, but didn't last that long.
Mm.
This is 70 years on.
Mm.
And so you don't think that's going to undermine trust in government?
Mm.
You bet it is. And so the truth embargoes and disclosure, in my view, could be a huge turning point in bringing people back to the idea that, hey, my government wants to tell me the truth, so I'm going to listen.
Mm.
I'm not going to simply fall in line, but I'm going to listen.
Mm.
And so let's hope that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I might add one thing to that. You know, I feel, and, you know, it might be controversial. You may not agree with me, but you mentioned To the Stars Academy kicking the door open on this issue in 2017. And really, it wasn't To the Stars Academy completely, you know, because the military, like the industrial complex, does not – it does not agree to data leaks, you know. And if To the Stars Academy was handed those videos, it was for the exact reason that the military industrial complex wants this truth embargo to end themselves. Some people within that
–
organization. Some, not a lot, but some. The old guard is still there that is holding things tight, just like they were for 70 years. But let me say that they're kicking themselves in the ass now, because they literally have lied for this whole time. That big data release comes out and people are even looking at that and saying, I don't believe it, because of all-time, you know, the all-time height of distrust with our governments. And so how they're going to gain trust back from the public, I don't know. I don't know if the UFO issue is going to be the complete end-all in that. It's vindicating for me, because I've been researching this for a while. Stephen Bassett even longer, and many folks like Stanton Friedman who have passed, they didn't even get to see the true disclosure event happen.
I
hope it happens this year, but I'm a bit skeptical sometimes too, because of the history of lying. And why would they decide to finally come forward and tell the truth, you know, to undo all the lying?
Well, well, that's how you undo a lie. You tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, that is exactly how you undo a lie. And the answer to your question is, how can they get people to start to believe what they're saying on this issue?
Hmm.
Congressional hearings. That's why you have them. All right. In other words, you have witnesses coming forward, not one, not two, not three, 10, 12, 14, 15, multiple hearings, and they're – if they're military, all the better, under oath, penalty of perjury, giving collection of evidence in front of the people and being asked questions by the Congress. So people literally see the act of truth happening right in front of them.
Hmm.
That's how you get the trust back. That's how you begin it, with hearings. If you just suddenly make an announcement, oh yeah, there's ETs here. Sorry, we kept it from you. Bye, I've got a lunch. No, they get people like, what?
Yeah.
What? Yes. So again, when I say we need hearings, I say we really need hearings. And of course, that's the way they're going to do it, which is why that's the groundwork is being laid for hearings. I mean, it's not rocket science in that regard. The trick is, because there's so many entities involved and so much history, and the truth embargo has created a negative context that we're still undoing. This is not an easy thing to pull off. That's why I have great respect for the To the Stars Academy. And yes, you're absolutely right. To be totally fair, there is a group behind them that allowed this to happen and is encourages and provided. And I'll tell you, as soon as they, you know, announce themselves, I'm going to heap praise on them. But fortunately, we don't know who they are. So given that, I'm certainly not going to I'm not going to say the DOD is doing this, because that's not the case. So I'm going to say, wow, the DOD is coming around. No. But people within it, and not just within the DOD. I think there's probably people supporting it within the CIA. It's not an accident. There's like two full career CIA people on the To the Stars Academy. At least there were. You know, there still are. That's not an accident. In fact, intelligence is all over that organization. So there's probably support there as well. So this amalgam of people, which has to remain anonymous, totally understand, will eventually be known. And they will probably take a very significant place in history, which they will well deserve.
No, I think that's a very valid point you make, Darcy, because it is clear that they could only have got that information if someone wanted them to have it. And clearly, because of what had happened to this footage and how it had been stored and dealt with, clearly, you know, we're talking some very well connected and very powerful people behind the scenes in a specific faction of the Department of Defense that clearly are rebelling against the old guard, or don't simply feel that this issue can be held back anymore.
Darcy and I agree on that, absolutely. And it's also who they are that makes it. In other words, these are careerists who held high security clearances within the DOD, within the CIA, and so forth. And so you can't let them suddenly just go out and form an organization, and you have all kinds of ways that you can stop them. All kinds of ways that you can stop. Now, you couldn't stop a bunch of kids at MIT that got a bunch of information, want to form an organization and go to the New York Times. You probably couldn't stop that very easily. But people like this, absolutely. And they didn't.
Yes.
That doesn't mean they're happy about it, but they didn't. And so, again, I have high confidence in my analysis of this. And if I've got it wrong, I invite anybody who's really in the know, get in touch, straighten me out. I'll adjust my assessment. But nobody's contacted me yet.
And we've not had the usual thing that happened with anybody else in the past, you know, when we've had people involved in Roswell. And I know you mentioned in this documentary, Robert Salas is another one. These people over the years have had their reputations destroyed by the authorities and people in power. That hasn't happened over the last 3 or 4 years since this footage has been released. That alone is very telling and gives them a real air of authority and authenticity. I think that, you know, 25 years ago, if this had happened, we'd have seen all kinds of black operations going on and character assassinations, I suspect.
It's a little of that. They gave the Clintons a hard time. One of the untold stories of the Clinton administration, and I don't know how the hell it's ever going to get told, to be honest with you, is that, and if you were paying attention, you might remember this, but the Clintons came in kind of somewhat naive out of Arkansas, and the establishment just pounded them. They never let up. It was one scandal after another, after another, after another. The right wing really went crazy. Richard Mellenskaith, a heavy duty right winger who helped found the Enterprise Institute, a right wing think tank. They were just putting stuff out all the time. And I deeply suspect that they might have gotten help from the CIA, which keeps dossiers, or the FBI, that does extensive dossiers on all candidates for president. And then once you're actually in the final election, heavy-duty dossier. So they know huge amounts that are not supposed to be revealed. It's supposed to be simply kept, unless they discover something that truly makes you a national security threat, in which they may step in. Otherwise, so anything you did wrong, did you lie to your wife once, or, you know, what? I mean, did you cheat on your SAT scores? Whatever, they know this. And so I think they may have cooperated with the right wing there because, and again, the scandals never stopped, and then eventually they got him. They got him on impeachment, which tied him up in the second term. But I believe that was because Rockefeller approached the administration in March 29. He'd only been in office about 60 days. and said, look, I want to get into this issue. I want to talk to the president, do a report, want to get the files released. And thus the Rockefeller Initiative began. And it wasn't some secret project. It was known. It wasn't publicized. Only one or two articles were ever written about it while he was in office.
Yeah,
because it was that time, right? It was still early, but plenty of people knew, including the CIA, the FBI. They all knew, and so suddenly they got this guy. They have a president who they don't like. The military hated Clinton. He was a draft dodger to them. He was a womanizer. He was a pot smoker. He was all this stuff. Remember, this is 1993, and they didn't want to cooperate with him. And so they suddenly learned that a billionaire Rockefeller is got his nose under the door of the White House, and they're talking ETs, UFOs. And Clinton starts actually making moves. He starts asking for stuff. John Podesta, I think, by and large, was the one that was doing the asking, but and they had to respond. They had to come up. So this was not good. They were not happy. And I have a feeling that a lot of the attacks that were generated to the Clintons was because they had to neutralize him. They had to take as much political capital away from him as possible. They couldn't attack him on the issue itself. All right. They did start, and he knew it, and Hillary knew it, and that's a whole nother story. But they were absolutely petrified that he might actually he could have. I mean, he didn't. He was stonewalled, but he could have broke that wall down. He was the president of the United States. He could have fired every single one of the top people in the Pentagon and said, look, I want the files. And they said, well, we're not going to give them to you. And he'd fire them and bring in another group until he got somebody who would give it to him. He could have done that. The political capital would have been enormous, but still he could have done it. So I have a feeling that happened. So that was then. That's not the way things are now. Obviously, we're in a whole other place, thank God. But it's, what, 25 friggin' years?
Yeah.
A quarter century. When I got into this in 96, I never dreamed it would take this long.
Yeah.
I just didn't think it could be possible. But then things happened, and history intervened, and I sort of saw the effect of that, and I sort of recognized that, hey, when you do this path, when you do an activist path at the high level, high-end issues, big issues, history can just knock you for a loop anytime it wants. If you're some local person trying to clean up a river, it's a little less, you know, it doesn't take 70 years.
Yeah.
But when you deal with stuff like this, it can easily take 70 years, as I have found out.
Absolutely. Very true, Stephen. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your thought-provoking conversation this evening. Darcy, what's next for you, and what are you working on, as well as where can everybody get hold of your fantastic documentaries?
Sure. They can check out my website, www.occultjourneys.com. All my released films are up there, the posters, trailers, and they can click through and watch, you know, the films on any site when they click on the poster. And I'm just Darcy Weir by the same name under Facebook and Instagram. Welcome to connect with me there. I love your feedback on my films. I'm currently working on releasing a crop circle documentary, so that's a little close to your home, Paul. Maybe we can chat about that in the future. That's going to be out in March. And Stephen Bassett's in that as well, as Gary King, a pretty prevalent crop circle researcher in the UK. And then I'm working on a secret space documentary, trying to put together all the facts surrounding space UFOs and the concealment of that information from the public by the Department of Defense and NASA.
Fantastic. Look thoroughly forward to all of that, Darcy, going on your body of work so far, my friend. It's an outstanding body that you've built so far, so anything you're involved in, I'll certainly absorb with eager anticipation. So fantastic. Stephen, yourself, where can everybody keep up to date with you and track your constant battle, my friend?
The website is paradigmresearchgroup.org, and then I have a podcast that is just launched, got the initial introductory video up. That can be found in many places, but the easy one is Disclosure Wire, one word, disclosurewire.org. and that's the Disclosure Wire podcast. You can subscribe to my free newsletter or updates list on my website. It's a subscription thing right there. It's really easy to do. Consider please following Paradigm Research Group on Twitter and on Facebook. I recently lost 1,200 Twitter followers, just disappeared out of nowhere. I don't know what happened. Hopefully it's not something I said, but I'm not the only one, apparently. They just evaporated. So I'm very sensitive to that, so I'm trying to rebuild it. But you're only as it's a Twitter world, we just live in it. You're only as influencing as the size of your Twitter follower. So I need as many as I can get. Spread the word. And that's how you get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure I put links, as always, gentlemen, in the show notes for the show. And once again, thank you so much, Stephen. You're someone I've wanted to speak to for a very long time. You're a bright light of truth in a beacon of governmental darkness over the last quarter of a century. So thank you for taking the time to join me for the first time. And you are always welcome to return whenever you wish.
Yeah. Let's not wait so long the next time.
Absolutely. Darcy, thank you again, my friend. We're making this a regular thing.
Thank you,
I look
Paul.
Forward to the next time you can join me.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. It's been great. And keep doing the great work that you're doing. Cheers.